We'll venture into Spaceport, Indiana in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the rather quiet headquarters of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, with this Rain Report. Does the name Brian Tanner ring a bell with you? Probably not. Borrowing from his LinkedIn write-up, Brian Tanner is President, Chairman of Spaceport, Indiana. A civilian astronaut, Brian has been involved in the commercial space program from the early days. He served on the first Spaceport Council under the Commercial Spacecraft Federation and built the Spaceport, Indiana program. He developed the Spaceport Outreach Program for Education, which now serves two states and has become the largest STEM provider in Indiana. He has created many platforms to serve national interest regarding post-disaster assessment, communications links for military environments using HALO technologies, and launch systems, to name a few. Brian is considered one of the foremost leaders in technology transition to education within Indiana and has developed a number of award-winning programs. He was awarded the MIRA Award in 2011 for his contributions to technology in education. A NASA Top Star winner and over 50 other awards to date. He is a distinguished lecturer for the U.S. Navy and frequent keynote speaker on commercial space topics as well as education. So what was Brian Tanner talking about during the Balloon Sat Forum at the 2016 Dayton Hamvention? Spaceport, Indiana, of course.
Many, many years ago, I sat down in Las Cruces, New Mexico, with a few different folks, Bill Brown being one of them, and we sat on a committee and decided, you know, this space thing is not always going to be actively funded by the taxpayers. Not everybody's going to be as overzealous as to think that they're going to put billions of dollars in the space program year after year, and how are we going to continue it? So we decided, you know, there's got to be a commercial space industry. And with that, we decided, well, you know, let's start to create some partners and create this thing, and we did. And so we spent our time working with the FAA and AST 100 office and a bunch of other people. Before you knew it, people were being funded for a variety of different things. Now, a lot of them got tons more money than I got. I think Elon Musk got $1 billion, and Branson got a few dollars, and people started building spaceports. And I had been down in Florida in 2007 when President Obama decided that when he came into office then in 2009 that we're going to get rid of this Constellation project. And we all walked off the platforms at 39A and B and came back. And my goal was to come back to Indiana and try to do something on a smaller level that would help promote the commercial space industry. A lot of people say, well, why would you want to build a spaceport in Indiana? You can't launch manned flights from there, but you can certainly launch a lot of other things from there. As we develop not only radio frequency systems, but also computerized systems, return payload capabilities, the size of rockets, and the materials that we're building them from, we finally find out that there's room for inland spaceports across the country. In other words, we can build things and launch them from Indiana, and with returning parafoils, steerable parafoils, the nanotechnologies we have and material selections, we can bring those parts back to us and reuse them. So we could not only have returnable but reusable platforms. And so in a meeting one time in February, I was in Washington, D.C. and sat down with a guy named Dave Mastin, and he created Mastin Aerospace. And it wasn't too many more years after that that he won $1 million or so from Google because he launched a rocket and returned it to within 45 centimeters of where he launched it from. And it was a crazy, crazy thing to watch this happen. Remember in the days when Bill Brown was out there launching stuff off the Gulf and doing crazy stuff like that, we sent it downrange and it was lost. Or if it wasn't lost, it wasn't easily recoverable. And so we started to change the dynamic of space. And how did radio frequency technology play a role in that? Well, it was huge. Because not only could we do things so much cheaper and faster than the federal government could ever do it, but we turned it into something that was so viable that it led us to wonderful gains in our high-altitude ballooning and amateur rocketry and all kinds of things. Right up until now, as we're watching 300,000 new drones be registered with the FAA, we're seeing the great work that's been done by radio frequency ham operators and scientists and engineers. And so the spaceport is a culmination of those kinds of things. There are 24 of us around the world, 11 in the United States and a few others around the world. And our whole idea is just to be able to promote not only the education, getting people reignited and excited about space and science and engineering, but also to really move the country forward in a way that we can do it cheaper, faster, and better than we used to be able to do it before. We do lots of high-altitude balloon flights at the spaceport. I think we're pretty close to 300 now, maybe a little less than that, maybe 250. We've been doing a number of flights out of Indiana since 2008. I have to say that this is kind of an exciting time. It was just about this time 15 years ago that I met Bill Brown through High Altitude Research Corporation and a company that I had. And about 10 years ago, Bill was nice enough to come up and come to work for me up in Peru, Indiana. And it was 10 years ago this month that we actually sat in a little town called Bunker Hill, Indiana, and flew one of the first unmanned air vehicles in Indiana, one of the first in the region, and we did it with an old micropilot out of Canada that would hardly work, that we spent lots of time re-engineering. We went to Fry Electronics and bought a couple of joysticks and a thruster, and we used an old laptop and a Futaba controller, and we took it off manually and flipped the switch, and that was the first autonomous, net-centric, heterogeneous flight of a UAV in Indiana. And that was 10 years ago this month, so thank you, Bill, for that. That was a great time. I can only tell you that in that experience with Bill Brown, it was when I first got to understand radio frequency technology, really got to understand how important weight was and how much equipment you could put into something and still make it fly. And I would ask Bill questions, well, how about if we add this? And how about if we do this? And could we add this to it? And Bill, in his uncanny way, would just look at me and smile because he knew at that point I was an electronic idiot. I had no idea. And so he taught me over the years how to take what I already knew and apply it into something that had to be really lightweight. What are we doing at Spaceport, and how is ham radio going to play a role in this? Right now, down around Franklin, Indiana, there's about 30 acres sitting next to the highway that we're going to turn into what we would imagine a lunar or Martian colony is going to look like. Over that 30 acres, it's going to be a system of buildings and infrastructure that will give people an understanding, especially at a young age, about how they would think about engaging in science and space technology in the future over the next 3 or 4 decades. And as part of this 30 acres, which is called the Spaceport, LBE, Life Beyond Earth, the idea is to say, how can we use the technologies that we're developing today if we want to create a habitat somewhere else on another planet or another celestial body? There's a big dish in the middle, which I love, radio frequency astronomy. We've done that a number of times at Space Days where we've had kids bouncing their voices off the moon or listening to the sounds of planets. But all the host of things, for example, that radio frequency technology will do in places like this, we've had RF capability, ham radio capability on the International Space Station for a number of years now, where students have had the opportunity to talk with astronauts as they come around overhead. But there's so many ways in which we can engage, and often when we deal with students in our space camp, they have no experience with ham radio. They've never been introduced to it. They don't understand how exciting it can be. But the minute they can bounce their voice off something, or they can talk to someone hundreds of miles away, or you can put a radio on a high-altitude balloon. And we did this one year with a couple of handheld radios from Walmart. And those kids talked 700 miles apart to people, beyond line of sight. We had a high-altitude balloon and a repeater sitting up at 40, 50,000 feet at that point. So it was an awesome opportunity. So they just begin to touch a little bit with their experiences. We don't have enough, and somebody said this earlier, we don't have enough hands-on opportunities in engineering. Students go to school, they learn the concepts, they maybe get an opportunity to solder a circuit board together, but beyond that, they really don't have the experience. And so we're teaching them, starting off in the third grade, about how they can get engaged with this kind of technology. And so we launch a balloon, and they put their payloads together. They understand what repeaters look like, or they understand what's going on in APRS, and how is that signal obtained, and how is it translated into a two-dimensional layout so they can understand what it really looks like from a visual standpoint. We have our ham radio operators come out and teach them how frequencies work. What is 2 meters? And why is it called 2 meters? And how do we figure that out? And what's 300 million miles an hour? And what do all these things mean? And they have a great time with it. And so as we set up this 30-acre spot, it becomes a hands-on teaching and learning environment in which they can figure out there's modules that they'll live in while they're there for the camps that are very restrictive. They have very limited space and very limited capabilities. They might have some electronics and communications capabilities, but what's it like to be isolated? What's it like to know that if you step outside, it's going to be 250 degrees below zero in the dark? And what's a vacuum? What's hardened radiation? What's microgravity? That's a typical winter in Indiana. I mean, if you're there in October, starting in October through about March.
You're listening to a talk given during the 2016 Dayton Hamvention BalloonSat Forum by Brian Tanner, President and Chairman of Spaceport Indiana, whose focus is so-called STEM programs, a curriculum-based idea of educating students in four specific disciplines: science, technology, engineering, and math, in an interdisciplinary and applied approach. We'll conclude our excerpt from his Hamvention talk in a moment.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
So these kids get to understand what all these dynamics mean, and they wouldn't learn it without high-altitude ballooning and the use of ham radio frequency. And so, again, we have RF astronomy. We're going to be subjecting them to all kinds of communications capabilities. They're going to be learning how to develop hardware that's very lightweight, that doesn't take up much space, that can withstand all the harshness. So it's a living environment and a habitat. But here's one other thing that we're doing. None of you would know this, obviously, because you don't know me very well, but I have a grandson who's 2 years old, was born 2014, and on April 1st, he drowned in a retention pond. And he was rescued after about 30 minutes, and he was revived, and he survived. However, he has a huge amount of neurological and brain damage. It affects his thalamus, the middle part of his brain that suffered anoxia. He no longer has the ability to do many things that we would do as part of our normal life. He doesn't speak, he can't move his arms much, and he doesn't move his legs. And that's probably his new life. But what we understand about these people is we understand that his brain is still alive. And his brain is a series of connections. It's a hardwiring system. It will regrow to a certain degree, and things will change. It'll bypass certain parts of the brain that don't thrive anymore to find new ways to do things. And many, many years ago, when I was in college, I wrote a study for NASA about the effects of spaceflight on your cardiac and pulmonary system. And at that time, we talked a lot about sensory perception and sensory deprivation. And if you're working in the space program or gone through some of the astronaut training I did through the folks in Pennsylvania and some places down in Houston here in the last couple of years, they teach you a lot about the existence without human sensory capability or the huge disconnect that you can have. And when you get dipped down in that pool in Houston, one of the first things, the most fundamental things you learn that you have to get around is communication. Because you can't just talk to somebody next to you and say, hey, hand me that wrench. Just that basic, simple thing of communicating goes away. It changes your life pretty dramatically. So I went back to that thought that I had a few years ago and decided, with the help of one of my business partners here, Daryl Pitts, is our VP of business units. I said, Daryl, we need to do a human sensory deprivation lab. Because one of the things we understand about people is, especially if they have multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, CP, brain trauma, and injuries, is there's a huge disconnect often. There's somebody in there thriving, but they can't connect to the outside world. Autism, Asperger's disease, all these kinds of things. And since the brain is composed of waves of neuromotor platelets and electronic pathways and connectivity, your brain is very similar to a circuit board in some ways. So what we thought about doing by creating this human sensory deprivation lab was to create environments in which we could take sensory perception away from human beings and figure out what it's really like to care for them. If you're a caregiver, if you're a doctor, a nurse, a respiratory therapist, you have no idea what it's like to lay in that bed and be someone who can't communicate with the outside world. So what we do is we give you the experience of understanding what it's like to be them. We take away your sense of smell and taste and feeling. Orientation, spatial disorientation is created, and we give you an opportunity to understand what it's like to be that person laying in bed.
Brian, you're talking about those flotation tanks where you're floating in.
In some ways, the other one is we're going to build a silo. LCD and LED technology, they've now developed curtain LEDs and LCDs, and we can create a silo and line it with these screens, these curtain screens, and actually give someone the sense that they're doing an EVA, a walk. We can put them in a harness, lift them off the ground, completely black the silo out, create a space-like environment. What we can do in that cell is take away all kinds of sensory capabilities, sound being one of them, communications being another, sense of touch, and so forth. So that's just one way which we do it. Water is another way. We stick people in the water. But the idea is that we can give caregivers an opportunity to understand what that environment is like, to be that person. But also, we'll be able to use that to score individuals who already suffer from certain disease. If any of you know children or adults with autism, you'll understand that they have a real problem sometimes with being overwhelmed. I might give you an example here. My grandson, his vision is, because of his brain injury, is like looking at a widescreen television with half of it missing. Your inputs, what your eyeballs take in basically, have two pathways. Some of them go laterally across the brain, and then a couple of them cross the pituitary gland in the middle of the brain. What happened with his is because the center of his brain was destroyed, the waves of information across the pituitary gland were lost. But what he does have are these parallel lateral inputs. And so what ends up happening is what he can see right now is like half of what he used to be. But what data comes through that is so overwhelming because he only has one point at which that information can come in, his brain decides to throw some of it away and only process what he can. It's a very interesting paradigm. But if you can take kids with autism and other problems and score them, how much light is too much light? How much sound is too much sound? I don't know if you know this, but theaters now don't dim the lights all the way down like they used to anymore because people who suffer from Asperger's and autism, they can't stand the contrast between the light and the dark. And so it becomes overwhelming to them and they can't tolerate it. How many times have you maybe seen children who can't take the stimulus of sound? Too much sound or too many frequencies, too many types of frequencies of sound create a problem for them. It's overwhelming. They can't stand that stimulus. So we can put kids in these environments and score them and find out what their tolerances are so that we can then develop a customized rehabilitation system that works specifically for them, tailoring their rehabilitation. You say, well, how does this connect with what I do as a ham radio operator? What's this simple? We can use frequency. We can use stimulus. We can use sound. We can teach people in the caregiving industry, what is a waveform? What kind of frequencies generate what kinds of feelings? How can we stimulate the brain or the sensories of touch and other senses based on things that we know we can create using radio frequency technology? And we're going to teach kids how to do that. We're going to teach students how to work in our labs and do those same things. So I guess the point I'm trying to get to is we've always had this old school of being able to say, look, we can send a signal from one place to another. We can talk from one place to another. That's what ham radio is fun. It's entertaining to do that. But what we can also do is use what we know to start creating new opportunities for people to learn, new skill sets in healthcare, in rehab care, in space and science technology. They're all a set of capabilities that we can use our technology and our knowledge towards new things and new developments. And so the spaceport as a whole is trying to look at ham radio just as one component to say, what can we do with what we know? How can we make it useful in another industry or in another way? And so inspiring kids to use these technologies is kind of an interesting approach to us. So you'll see that happening with ham radio. That's really what I wanted to talk to you about today was how we continue to encourage young people to get involved, to get their ham radio license. I see too many classes, even in Indianapolis, when I go on the internet to try to find where we can teach kids how to get their technician's license, for example. So we want to engage people as much as we can, teach them about new opportunities. I think there's an exciting future for ham radio that a lot of kids in the third and fourth grade and another generation of people just haven't discovered yet. I'm grateful for what you guys are doing in communications and the exciting stuff you're doing on college campuses as we are. I want you to start thinking, if you can, about what you're doing and the impact it can have on a whole different industry and a whole different set of capabilities that you might not have thought about before. And then when we get this built in the next year and a half or so, you'll come and visit us and engage with us and the students that are there and come teach them what you know so that they can learn something. High altitude ballooning is where we really got the start at this and what really made the difference in being able to expand the use of radio frequency technology into very useful fields. So your technology developments have been awesome. That's what we're doing as a spaceport, why we continue to make ham part of our STEM curriculum and will over the next few years.
And that concludes our excerpt from the 2016 Dayton Hamvention Balloon Sat Forum Talk given by Brian Tanner, President and Chair of Spaceport Indiana. For more background about Spaceport Indiana, go to spaceportindiana.com. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2016 Rain, all rights reserved. Just a personal note that Rain's founder and producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP's production PC, crashed July 1st. His new and improved production box should be up and running by the 15th, thanks to Bite Me Computers. I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY. And this Rain Report is a weekly production, well, most of the time anyway, of the Amateur Radio Information Network at www.therainreport.com, at The Rain Report on Twitter, and via iTunes.